feel the need to say something grand and poetic, but the only thing I come up with is, it's lovely. He says, lovely is a lovely word that should be used more often. Then I get an idea. Over my desk, I've got this enormous bulletin board, and on it I've tacked black and white photographs of writers at work. I take these down and dig through my desk until I come up with a stack of brightly colored post-its. On one of them I write, lovely. Half an hour later, I stand back and look at the board. It is covered in fragments. Some are words or sentences that may or may not become story ideas. Others are lines I like from books. In the last column, I have a section for New Nameless Web Magazine. On three separate post-its, I've tacked beneath it, Lit, Love, Life. I'm not sure what these are supposed to be. Categories or articles or just nice-sounding words. Even though it isn't much yet, I take a picture and send it to Finch. I write, look what you've got me doing. Every half hour I check for a response, but by the time I go to bed, I still haven't heard from him.
Finch. Days 23, 24, 25. Last night is like a puzzle, only not put together. All the pieces are scattered everywhere and some are missing. I wish my heart wouldn't beat so fast. I get out the books again and read the good words Decca left behind, but they blur on the page so that they don't make sense. I can't concentrate. And then I start to clean and organize. I take down every single note until the wall is blank. I shove them into a trash bag, but this isn't enough, so I decide to paint. I'm sick of the red walls of my room. The color is too dark and depressing. This is what I need, I think, a change of scenery. This is why the room feels off. I get into Little Bastard and drive to the nearest hardware store and buy primer and 10 gallons of blue paint, because I'm not sure how much it will take. It takes many, many coats to cover the red. No matter what I do, it seeps right through, like the walls are bleeding. By midnight, the paint still isn't dry, and so I gather up the black comforter and shove it into the back of the linen closet in the hall, and I dig around until I find an old blue comforter of Kate's. I spread this on my bed. I open the windows and move my bed into the middle of the room, and then I climb under the blanket and go to sleep. The next day, I paint the walls again. It takes 2 days for them to hold the color, which is the clear, bright blue of a swimming pool. I lie on my bed, feeling easier, like I can catch my breath. Now we're talking, I think. Yes. The only thing I leave alone is the ceiling, because white contains all the wavelengths of the visible spectrum at full brightness. Okay, this is technically true of white light and not white paint, but I don't care. I tell myself that all the colors are there anyway, and this gives me an idea. I think of writing it as a song, but instead I sign on to the computer and send a message to Violet. You are all the colors in one, at full brightness.
Violet and Finch. Violet. 135, 134, 133 days to go. Finch doesn't show up at school for a week. Someone says he's been suspended. Others say he overdosed and was carted off to rehab. The rumors spread the old-fashioned way, in whispers and texts, because Principal Wirtz has found out about the Bartlett dirt and shut it down. Wednesday, first period. In honor of the Dirt's demise, Jordan Grippenwalt is passing out celebration candy. Troy Satterfield sticks two suckers in his mouth and says around them,
"Where's your boyfriend, Violet? Shouldn't you be on suicide watch?"
He and his friends laugh. Before I can say anything, Jordan yanks the suckers out of his mouth and throws them in the garbage. On Thursday, I find Charlie Donahue in the parking lot after last period. I tell him I'm working with Finch on a class project and that I haven't heard from him for a few days. I don't ask if the rumors are true, even though I want to. Charlie tosses his books into the back seat of his car.
"That's just his thing. He comes and goes when he wants."
He takes off his jacket and throws this on top of the books.
"One thing you'll learn is he is one moody old todger."
Brenda Shank Kravitz walks up and past us and opens the passenger door. Before she gets in, she says to me, "I like your glasses." I can tell she actually means it. "Thanks. They were my sister's." She looks like she's thinking this over, and then she nods, "Okay." The next morning, on my way to third period, I see him in the hallway, Theodore Finch. Only, he's different. For one thing, he's wearing a ratty red knit cap, loose black sweater, jeans, sneakers, and these fingerless black gloves. Homeless Finch, I think. Slacker Finch. He's leaning against a locker, one knee bent, talking to Chimeli Belk Gupta, one of the junior year drama girls. He doesn't seem to notice me as I walk by. In third period, I hook my bag over my chair and take out my calculus book. Mr. Heaton says,
"Let's start by going over the homework."
But he barely gets the words out before the fire alarm starts blaring. I gather my stuff and follow everyone outside. A voice behind me says,
"Meet me in the student parking lot."
I turn, and Finch is standing there, hands shoved into pockets. He walks away as if he's invisible, and we aren't surrounded by teachers and faculty, including Principal Wirtz, braying into his phone. I hesitate, and then start to run, bag slapping against my hip. I'm scared to death someone will come after me, but it's too late to go back because I'm already running. I run until I catch up with Finch, and then we run faster, and no one has shouted at us to stop, come back here. I feel terrified, but free. We race across the boulevard that cuts in front of the school and alongside the trees that separate the main parking lot from the river that splits the town in half. When we come to a break in the trees, Finch takes my hand.
"Where are we going?"
I'm breathing hard.
"Down there, but be quiet. First one to make a noise has to streak back to school."
He is talking fast, moving fast.
"Streak how?"
"Streak naked. That's what streaking means. It is, I believe, the very definition of the word."
I slip and slide down the embankment while Finch leads the way soundlessly, making it look easy. When we get to the edge of the river, he points across it, and at first I can't see what he's showing me. Then something moves and catches my eye. The bird is about 3 feet tall, with a red crown on a white head and a charcoal gray body. It splashes in the water and then pecks around the opposite bank, strutting like a man.
"What is it?"
"A hooded crane. The only one in Indiana. Maybe the only one in the United States. They winter in Asia, which means he's about 7,000 miles from home."
"How did you know he was here?"
"Sometimes when I can't stand it over there,"
he nods in the direction of the high school,
"I come down here. Sometimes I go for a swim, and other times I just sit. This guy's been hanging around about a week now. I was afraid he was hurt."
"He's lost."
"Uh-uh. Look at him."
The bird stands in the shallows, pecking at the water, then wades deeper and starts splashing around. He reminds me of a kid in a swimming pool.
"See, Ultraviolet? He's wandering."
Finch steps back, shielding his eyes because the sun is peeking through the branches, and there is a crack as his foot comes down on a twig.
"Bollocks," he whispers.
"Oh, my God. Does that mean you have to streak back to school now?" The look on his face is so funny that I can't help laughing. He sighs, drops his head in defeat, and then pulls off his sweater, his shoes, his hat, his gloves, and his jeans, even though it's freezing out. He hands each item to me until he's wearing only his boxers. And I say, "Off with them, Theodore Finch. You were the one who said streaking, and I believe streaking implies full-on nakedness. I believe, in fact, it is the very definition of the word." He smiles, his eyes never leaving mine. And, just like that, he drops his boxers. I'm surprised because I only half thought he would do it. He stands, the first real live naked boy I've ever seen, and doesn't seem one bit self-conscious. He is long and lean. My eyes trace the thin blue veins of his arms and the outline of muscle in his shoulders and stomach and legs. The scar across his middle is a bright red gash.
He says, "This would be a hell of a lot more fun if you were naked, too."
And then he dives into the river, so neatly that he barely disturbs the crane. He cuts through the water with broad strokes like an Olympic swimmer, and I sit on the bank watching him. He swims so far, he's just a blur. I pull out our notebook and write about the wandering crane and a boy with a red cap who swims in winter. I lose track of time, and when I look up again, Finch is drifting toward me. He floats on his back, arms folded behind his head.
"You should come in."
"That's okay. I'd rather not get hypothermia."
"Come on. Ultraviolet remarkable. The water's great."
"What did you call me?"
"Ultraviolet remarkable. Going once, going twice."
"I'm fine right here."
"All right."
He swims toward me until he can stand waist deep. "Where were you this time?"
"I was doing some remodeling."
He scoops at the water as if he's trying to catch something. The crane stands still on the opposite shore watching us. "Is your dad back in town?" Finch seems to catch whatever he's looking for. He studies his cupped hands before letting it go.
"Unfortunately."
I can't hear the fire alarm anymore, and I wonder if everyone's gone inside. If so, I'll be counted absent. I should be more worried than I am, especially now that I've gotten detention, but instead I sit there on the bank. Finch swims toward shore and comes walking toward me. I try not to stare at him, dripping wet and naked, so I watch the crane, the sky, anything but him. He laughs.
"I don't guess you've got a towel in that enormous bag you carry around."
"No." He dries off with his sweater, shakes his hair at me like a dog so that I get sprayed, and then pulls on his clothes. When he's dressed again, he shoves his hat into his back pocket and smooths his hair off his face. "We should go back to class," I say. His lips are blue, but he's not even shivering.
"I've got a better idea. Want to hear it?"
Before he can tell me what it is, Ryan, Romer, and Joe Wyatt come sliding down the embankment.
"Great,"
Finch says under his breath. Ryan comes right over to me.
"We saw you take off during the fire alarm."
Romer gives Finch a nasty look.
"Is this part of the geography project? Are you wandering the riverbed or just each other?"
"Grow up, Romer," I say. Ryan rubs my arms like he's trying to warm me up.
"Are you okay?"
I shrug him off. "Of course I'm okay. You don't need to check up on me." Finch says,
"I didn't kidnap her, if that's what you're worried about."
Romer says,
"Did he ask you?"
Finch looks down at Romer. He has a good 3 to 4 inches on him.
"No, but I wish you would."
faggot.
Lay off, Romer. I snap at him. My heart is battering away because I'm not sure what's going to happen here. It doesn't matter what he says. You're just looking for a fight. I say to Finch, don't make it worse. Romer gets up in his face.
Why are you all wet? Decide to finally shower after all this time? No, man. I'm saving that activity for when I see your mom later.
Like that, Romer jumps on Finch, and the two of them go rolling down the bank into the water. Joe and Ryan just stand there, and I say to Ryan, do something!
I didn't start this.
Well, do something anyway! Romer swings and hits Finch's face with a thud. He swings again and again, his fist smashing into Finch's mouth, into his nose, into his ribs. At first, Finch isn't fighting back. He's just blocking the shots. But then he has Romer's arm twisted behind his back, and he's plunging his head into the water and holding it under. Let him go, Finch! He either doesn't hear me or isn't listening. Romer's legs are thrashing, and Ryan has Finch by the collar of his black sweater, and then by the arm, and is pulling on him.
Wyatt, some help here?
Let him go! Finch looks at me then, and for a second, it's like he doesn't know who I am. Let him go! I snap it at him, like I'm talking to a dog or a child. Just like that, he lets him go, straightens, picks Romer up, and drops him onto the bank, where he lies coughing up water. Finch goes stalking up the hill, past Ryan and Joe and me. His face is bloody, and he doesn't wait or look back. I don't bother going back to school because the damage is done. Because Mom won't expect me home yet, I sneak over to the parking lot, unlock Leroy, and ride to the east side of town. I cruise up and down the streets until I find the two-story brick colonial. Finch, it says on the mailbox. I knock on the door, and a girl with long black hair answers. Hey, she says to me, like she's not surprised I'm there. So you must be Violet. I'm Kate. I'm always fascinated by how the same genes rearrange themselves across brothers and sisters. People thought Eleanor and I were twins, even though her cheeks were narrower and her hair was lighter. Kate looks like Finch, but not. Same coloring, different features, except for the eyes. It's strange seeing his eyes in someone else's face. Is he here? I'm sure he's up there somewhere. I'm guessing you know where his room is. She smirks a little, but in a nice way, and I wonder what he's told her about me. Upstairs, I knock on his door. Finch? I knock again. It's Violet. There's no answer. I try the door, which is locked. I knock again. I tell myself he must be sleeping or have his headphones on. I knock again and again. I reach into my pocket for the bobby pin I carry with me, just in case, and bend down to examine the lock. The first one I ever picked was to the closet in my mom's office. Eleanor put me up to it because that's where our parents hid the Christmas presents. I discovered lock picking was a skill that comes in handy when you want to disappear during gym class or when you just need some peace and quiet. I give the knob a shake and then put the bobby pin away. I could probably pick this lock, but I won't. If Finch wanted to let me in, he would. When I get back downstairs, Kate is standing at the sink smoking a cigarette out the kitchen window, her hand dangling over the sill. Was he in there? When I say no, she throws her cigarette down the garbage disposal. Huh. Well, maybe he's asleep. Or he could have gone running. He runs? About 15 times a day. It's my turn to say, huh. You never can tell what that boy's going to do.
Finch. Day 27. I am still here. I stand at the window and watch her climb onto her bike. Afterward, I sit on the shower floor, the water beating down on my head, for a good 20 minutes. I can't even look at myself in the mirror. I turn on the computer because it's a connection to the world, and maybe that's what I need right now. The brightness of the screen hurts my eyes, and so I dim it way down until the shapes and letters are near shadows. This is better. I sign on to Facebook, which belongs only to Violet and me. I start at the beginning of our message chain and read every word, but the words don't make sense unless I hold my head and repeat them out loud. I try to read my downloaded version of The Waves, and when that isn't any better, I think, it's the computer, it's not me. And I find a regular book and thumb through it, but the lines dance across the page like they're trying to get away from me. I will stay awake. I will not sleep. I think of ringing up Ol' Embryo. I go so far as to fish his number out from the bottom of my backpack and punch it into my phone. I don't press call. I can go downstairs right now and let my mom know how I'm feeling, if she's even home, but she'll tell me to help myself to the Advil in her purse, and that I need to relax and stop getting myself worked up, because in this house there's no such thing as being sick unless you can measure it with a thermometer under the tongue. Things fall into categories of black and white. Bad mood, bad temper, loses control, feels sad, feels blue. You're always so sensitive, Theodore, ever since you were a little boy. Do you remember the cardinal? The one that kept flying into the glass doors off the living room? Over and over he knocked himself out and you said, "Bring him in to live with us, so we won't do that anymore." Remember? And then one day we came home and he was lying on the patio, and he'd flown into the door one too many times. And you called his grave a mud nest and said, "None of this would have happened if you'd let him come in." I don't want to hear about the cardinal again. Because the thing of it is, that cardinal was dead either way, whether he came inside or not. Maybe he knew it. And maybe that's why he decided to crash into the glass a little harder than normal that day. He would have died in here, only slower, because that's what happens when you're a finch. The marriage dies. The love dies. The people fade away. I put on my sneakers and bypass Kate in the kitchen. She says, "Your girlfriend was just here looking for you." I must have had my headphones on. "What happened to your lip and your eye?" "Please tell me she didn't do that." I ran into a door. She stares hard at me. "Everything okay with you?" "Yeah, super. I'm just going for a run." When I get back, the white of my bedroom ceiling is too bright, and so I turn it blue with what's left of the paint.
Violet. 133 days to go. 6 o'clock. Living room of my house. My parents sit across from me, their brows creased and unhappy. It seems Principal Wirtz called my mother when I failed to come back for the rest of third period, or show up for my 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th period classes. My dad is still dressed in the suit he wore to work. He does most of the talking.
"Where were you?"
"Technically just across the street from school."
"Where across the street?"
"The river."
"What in the hell were you doing at the river during school, during winter?"
In her even, calm voice, Mom says, "James." "There was a fire alarm, and we were all outside, and Finch wanted me to see this rare Asian crane."
"Finch?"
"The boy I'm doing the project with. You met him."
"How much is left to do on this project?"
"We have to visit one more place, and then we need to put everything together.
Mom says, Violet, we're very disappointed. This is like a knife in my stomach. My parents have never believed in grounding us or taking away our phones or computers, all the things Amanda's parents do to her when she gets caught breaking the rules. Instead, they talk to us and tell us how disappointed they are. Me, I mean. They talk to me. This isn't like you. Mom shakes her head. Dad says, You can't use losing your sister as an excuse to act out. I wish just once they'd send me to my room. I wasn't acting out. That wasn't what it was. It's just... I don't cheer anymore. I quit student council. I suck at orchestra. I don't have any friends or a boyfriend because it's not like the rest of the world stops, you know? My voice is getting louder, and I can't seem to do anything about it. Everyone goes on with their lives, and maybe I can't keep up. Maybe I don't want to. The one thing I'm good at, I can't do anymore. I didn't even want to work on this project, but it's kind of the only thing I have going on. And then, because they won't do it, I send myself to my room. I walk away from them just as my dad is saying, First of all, kiddo, you are good at many things, not just one. We eat dinner in almost silence, and afterward my mother comes up to my bedroom and studies the bulletin board above my desk. She says, What happened to EleanorandViolet.com? I let it go. There wasn't any point in keeping it. I guess not. Her voice is quiet, and when I look up, her eyes are red. I don't think I'll ever get used to it, she says, and then she sighs, and I've never heard anything like it. It's a sigh full of pain and loss. She clears her throat and taps the paper that reads, New Nameless Web Magazine. So, talk to me about this. I might create another magazine. Or I might not. I think my brain just naturally went there because of Eleanor and Violet. You liked working on it. I did. But if I started another one, I'd want it to be different. Not just the silly stuff, but also real thoughts, real writing, real life. She taps lit, love, life. And these? I don't know. They might be categories. She brings a chair over and sits next to me, and then she starts asking questions. Would this be for girls my age, or high school and beyond? Would I want to write all the content or work with contributors? What would be the purpose? Why do I want to start another magazine to begin with? Because people my age need somewhere they can go for advice or help or fun or just to be without anyone worrying about them. Somewhere they can be unlimited and fearless and safe, like in their own rooms. I haven't thought most of this out, and so I'd answer. I don't know. And maybe the whole thing is stupid. If I do anything, I have to start over. But all I have is fragments of ideas, just pieces. I wave at the computer, then at the wall. Like a germ of an idea for this, and a germ of an idea for that. Nothing whole or concrete. Growth itself contains the germ of happiness. Pearl S. Buck. Maybe a germ is enough. Maybe it's all you need. She props her chin in her hand and nods at the computer screen. We can start small. Open up a new document or pull out a blank piece of paper. We'll make it our canvas. Remember what Michelangelo said about the sculpture being in the stone? It was there from the beginning, and his job was to bring it out. Your words are in there, too. For the next 2 hours, we brainstorm and make notes
And at the end of it all, I have a very rough outline of a webzine and a very rough sketch of regular columns falling under the categories lit, love, and life. It's nearly 10 when she tells me goodnight. Mom lingers in the doorway and says, "Can you trust this boy, V?" I turn in my chair. "Finch?" "Yes." "I think so. Right now, he's pretty much the only friend I have. I'm not sure if this is a good or a bad thing." After she goes, I curl up on my bed, computer on my lap. There's no way I'll be able to create all the content. I write down a couple of names, including Brenda Schenk Kravitz, Jordan Grippenwalt, and Kate Finch, with a question mark beside it. Germ. I do a search, and it's available. www.germmagazine.com. 5 minutes later, it's purchased and registered. My stone. I switch to Facebook and send Finch a message. "I hope you're okay. Came by to see you earlier, but you weren't there. My parents found out about skipping school and aren't happy. I think this may mark the end of our wandering." My light is off and my eyes are closed when I realize that for the first time, I've forgotten to cross off the day on my calendar. I get up, feet hitting the cool wood floor, and walk over to my closet door. I pick up the black marker that I always leave within reach, uncap it, hold it up, and then my hand freezes in midair. I look at all the days laid out until graduation and freedom, and I feel a strange clutching in my chest. They are only a collection of days, less than half a year, and then who knows where I go and what I do. I cap the marker and grab one corner of the calendar and rip it down. I fold it up and shove it into the back of my closet, tossing the pen in after it. Then I slip out of my room and down the hall. Eleanor's door is closed. I push it open and go inside. The walls are yellow and covered in pictures of Eleanor and her Indiana friends, Eleanor and her California friends. The California state flag hangs above her bed. Her art supplies are piled in a corner. My parents have been working in here, slowly organizing her things. I set her glasses down on her dresser. "Thanks for the loan," I say, but they make my head hurt. And they're ugly. I can almost hear her laughing. Violet. Saturday. The next morning when I come downstairs, Theodore Finch is sitting at the dining room table with my parents. His red cap is hooked on the back of his chair, and he's drinking orange juice, an empty plate in front of him. His lip is split, and there's a bruise on his cheek.
"You look better without the glasses," he says.
"What are you doing here?" I stare at him, at my parents.
"I'm eating breakfast, the most important meal of the day. But the real reason I came is that I wanted to explain about yesterday. I told your parents it was my idea and that you didn't want to cut class, how you were only trying to keep me from getting in trouble by talking me into going back."
Finch helps himself to more fruit and another waffle. My dad says,
"We also discussed some ground rules for this project of yours."
"So I can still work on it?"
"Theodore and I have an understanding, don't we?"
Dad serves me a waffle and passes my plate down.
"Yes, sir."
Finch winks at me. My dad fixes him with a look.
"An understanding not to be taken lightly."
Finch composes himself.
"No, sir."
Mom says, "We told him we're putting our trust in him. We appreciate that he's gotten you back in the car again. We want you to have fun, within reason. Just be safe. And go to class."
Okay. I feel like I'm in a daze. Thank you. My father turns to Finch.
We'll need your phone number and contact info for your parents.
Whatever you need, sir.
Is your father the Finch of Finch Storage?
Yes, sir.
Ted Finch? Former hockey player?
That's the one, but we haven't spoken in years. He left when I was 10.
I'm staring at him as my mom says, I'm so sorry.
At the end of the day, we are better off without him, but thank you.
He gives my mom a sad and wounded smile, and unlike the story he's telling her, the smile is real.
My mother works at Broom Real Estate and bookmarks. She isn't home much, but if you have a pen, I'll give you her number.
I'm the one who brings him the pen and the paper, setting it down beside him, trying to catch his eye. But his dark head is bent over the notepad, and he's writing in straight block letters. Linda Finch, followed by all her numbers, work, home, and cell. And then Theodore Finch, Jr., followed by his own cell. The letters and numbers are neat and careful, like they were drawn by a child expecting to be graded. As I hand the paper to my dad, I want to say, that's another lie. That's not even his real handwriting. There is nothing about this boy that is neat and careful. My mom smiles at my dad, and it's a smile that means, time to lighten up. She says to Finch, so, what are your college plans? And the conversation turns chatty. When she asks Finch if he's thought about what he wants to do beyond college, as in with his life, I pay attention because I actually don't know the answer.
It changes every day. I'm sure you've read For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Mom answers yes for both of them.
Well, Robert Jordan knows he's going to die. There is only now, he says. And if now is only 2 days, then 2 days is your life, and everything in it will be in proportion. None of us knows how long we have. Maybe another month. Maybe another 50 years. I like living as if I only have that 2 days.
I'm watching my parents as Finch talks. He is speaking matter-of-factly but quietly, and I know this is out of respect for the dead, for Eleanor, who didn't have very long. My dad takes a drink of coffee and leans back, getting comfortable.
The early Hindus believed in living life to the fullest. Instead of aspiring to immortality, they aspired to living a healthy, full life.
He wraps up a good 15 minutes later with their earliest concept of the afterlife, which is that the dead reunite with Mother Nature to continue on Earth in another form. He quotes an ancient Vedic hymn.
May your eye go to the sun, to the wind your soul,
or go to the waters if it suits thee there.
Finch finishes. My dad's eyebrows shoot up toward his hairline, and I can see him trying to figure this kid out. Finch says,
I kind of have this thing about water.
My father stands, reaches for the waffles, and drops 2 onto Finch's plate. Inwardly, I let out a sigh of relief. Mom asks about our Wander Indiana project, and for the rest of breakfast, Finch and I talk about some of the places we've been so far, and some of the places we're planning to go. By the time we're done eating, my parents have become Call Me James and Call Me Cheryl instead of Mr. and Mrs. Markey. I half expect us to sit there all day with them, but then Finch turns to me, blue eyes dancing.
Ultraviolet, time's a-wastin'. We need to get this show on the road.
Outside, I say, why did you do that? Lie to my parents. He smooths the hair out of his eyes and pulls on the red cap.
Because it's not a lie if it's how you feel.
What does that mean? Even your handwriting was lying. For some reason, this makes me maddest.
If he's not real with them, maybe he's not real with me. I want to say, what else is a lie? He leans on the open passenger door, the sun behind him so I can't see his face.
Sometimes, Ultraviolet, things feel true to us, even if they're not.
Finch. Day 28. John Ivers is a polite, soft-spoken grandfather with a white baseball cap and a mustache. He and the missus live on a large farm way out in the Indiana countryside. Thanks to a website called Unusual Indiana, I have his telephone number. I've called ahead, just like the site said to do, and John is in the yard waiting for us. He waves and walks forward, shaking hands and apologizing that Sharon's gone off to the market. He leads us to the roller coaster he's built in his backyard. Actually, there are two. The Blue Flash and the Blue Two. Each seats one person, which is the only disappointing thing about it. But otherwise, it's really damn cool. John says, I'm not engineer educated, but I am an adrenaline junkie. Demolition derbies, drag racing, driving fast. When I gave them up, I tried to think of something I could do to replace them. Something that would give me that rush. I love the thrill of impending, weightless doom. So I built something to give me those feelings all the time. As he stands, hands on hips, nodding at the Blue Flash, I think about impending, weightless doom. It's a phrase I like and understand. I tuck it away in the corner of my mind to pull out later, maybe for a song. I say, you may be the most brilliant man I have ever met. I like the idea of something that can give you those feelings all the time. I want something like that. And then I look at Violet and think, there she is. John Ivers has built the roller coaster into the side of a shed. He says it measures 180 feet in length and climbs to a height of 20 feet. The speeds don't get above 25 miles per hour, and it only lasts 10 seconds. But there's an upside-down loop in the middle. To look at it, the flash is just twisted scrap metal painted baby blue with a 1970s bucket seat and a frayed cloth lap belt. But something about it makes my palms itch, and I can't wait to ride. I tell Violet she can go first. No, that's okay. You go. She backs away from the roller coaster like it might reach out and swallow her, and I suddenly wonder if this whole thing was a bad idea. Before I can open my mouth to say anything, John straps me into the seat and pushes me up the side of the shed till I feel and hear a click, and then up, up, up I go. He says, you might want to hold on, son, as I reach the top. And so I do as I hover, just for a second, at the very top of the shed, farmland spread out around me. And then off I shoot, down and into the loop, shouting myself hoarse. Too soon, it's over, and I want to go again because this is what life should feel like all the time, not just for 10 seconds. I do this 5 more times because Violet still isn't ready, and whenever I get to the end, she waves her hands and says, "Do it again." The next time I come to rest, I climb out, legs shaking, and suddenly Violet is taking a seat, and John Ivers is strapping her in, and then she's climbing up to the top, where she hovers. She turns her head to look in my direction, but suddenly she's off and diving and swooping and yelling her head off. When she comes to a stop, I can't tell if she's going to throw up or climb out and slap me. Instead, she shouts, "Again!" And she's off once more in a blur of blue metal and long hair and long legs and arms. We trade places then, and I go 3 times in a row, till the world looks upside down and tilted, and I feel the blood pumping hard in my veins. As he unbuckles the lap belt, John Ivers chuckles. That's a lot of ride. You can say that again. I reach for Violet because I'm not too steady on my feet, and it's a long way down if I fall. She wraps her arm around me, like it's second nature, and I lean into her, and she leans into me, until we make up one leaning person. Want to try the blue too? John wants to know, and suddenly I don't, because I want to be alone with this girl. But Violet breaks free and goes right to the roller coaster and lets John strap her in. The blue too isn't nearly so fun, so we ride the Flash twice more. When I step off for the last time, I take Violet's hand and she swings it back and forth, back and forth. Tomorrow I'll be at my dad's for Sunday dinner, but today I'm here. The things we leave behind are a miniature toy car we got at the dollar store, symbolizing Little Bastard, and two dollhouse figures, a boy and a girl, which we tuck inside an empty pack of American Spirit cigarettes. We cram it all into a magnetized tin the size of an index card. So that's it, Violet says, sticking it to the underside of the blue Flash. Our last wandering. I don't know. As fun as this was, I'm not sure it's what Black had in mind. I'll need to ruminate on it, understand, give it some good, hard thought. But we may need to choose a kind of backup place, just in case. The last thing I want to do is half-ass this, especially now that we have the support of your parents. On the way home, she rolls down the window, her hair blowing wild. The pages of our wandering notebook rattle in the breeze as she writes, head bent, one leg crossed over the other to make a kind of table. When she's like this for a few miles, I say, "What are you working on?" "Just making some notes. First I was writing about the blue Flash, and then about a man who builds a roller coaster in his backyard. But then I had a couple of ideas I wanted to get on paper." Before I can ask about these ideas, her head is bent over the notebook again, and the pen is scratching across the page. When she looks up again 2 miles later, she says, "You know what I like about you, Finch? You're interesting. You're different. And I can talk to you. Don't let that go to your head." The air around us feels charged and electric, like if you were to strike a match. The air, the car, Violet, me, everything might just explode. I keep my eyes on the road. "You know what I like about you, Ultraviolet Remarkable?" "Everything." "But I thought you didn't like me." And then I look at her. She raises an eyebrow at me. I go careering off onto the first exit I see. We roll past the gas station and the fast food joints and bump across the median into a parking lot. "East Township Public Library," the sign says. I wrench Little Bastard into park, and then I get out and walk around to her side. When I open the door, she says, "What the hell is going on?" "I can't wait. I thought I could, but I can't. Sorry." I reach across her and unsnap her seatbelt, then pull her out so we're standing face to face in this flat, ugly parking lot next to a dark library, a Chick-fil-A right next door. I can hear the drive-through cashier on the speaker asking if they want to add fries and a drink. "Finch?" I brush a loose strand of hair off her cheek. Then I hold her face in my hands and kiss her. I kiss her harder than I mean to, so I ease off a little. But then she's kissing me back. Her arms are around my neck, and I'm up against her, and she's against the car. And then I pick her up, and her legs are around me, and I somehow get the back door open. And then I'm laying her down on the blanket that's there. And I close the doors and yank off my sweater, and she pulls off her shirt, and I say, "You are driving me crazy. You have been driving me crazy for weeks." My mouth is on her neck, and she's making these gasping sounds. And then she says, "Oh my God, where are we?" And she's laughing, and I'm laughing, and she's kissing my neck, and my entire body feels like it's going to fucking explode, and her skin is smooth and warm, and I run my hand over the curve of her hip as she bites my ear, and then that hand is sliding into the hollow between her stomach and her jeans. She holds on to me tighter, and when I start undoing my belt, she kind of pulls away. And I want to bang my head against the wall of Little Bastard because, shit, she's a virgin. I can tell by the pull away. She whispers, "I'm sorry. All that time with Ryan? Close, but no." I run my fingers up and down her stomach. "Seriously. Why is it so hard to believe?" "Because it's Ryan Cross. I thought girls lost it just by looking at him." She slaps my arm and then lays her hand on top of mine and says, "This is the last thing I thought would happen today."
"Thanks."
"You know what I meant."
I pick up her shirt, hand it to her, pick up my sweater. As I watch her get dressed, I say, "Someday, Ultraviolet." And she actually looks disappointed. At home in my room, I am overcome by words. Words for songs. Words of places Violet and I will go before time runs out and I'm asleep again. I can't stop writing. I don't want to stop, even if I could. January 31st. Method. None. On a scale of 1 to 10 on the how close did I come scale, 0. Facts. The euthanasia coaster doesn't actually exist. But if it did, it would be a 3-minute ride that involves a climb nearly a third of a mile long up to 1,600 feet, followed by a sheer drop and 7 loops. That final descent and series of loops takes 60 seconds, but the 10G centrifugal force that results from the 223-mile-per-hour loops is what kills you. And then there is this strange fold in time, and I realize I'm not riding anymore. I'm running. I'm still wearing the black sweater and old blue jeans and sneakers and gloves, and suddenly my feet hurt. And somehow I've made it all the way to Centerville, which is the next town over. I take off my shoes and pull off my hat, and I walk all the way back home because, for once, I've worn myself out. But I feel good, necessary, and tired, and alive. Juliana Urbanus, the man who thought up the euthanasia coaster, claims it's engineered to humanely, with elegance and euphoria, take the life of a human being. Those 10 G's create enough centrifugal force on the body so that the blood rushes down instead of up to the brain, which results in something called cerebral hypoxia, and this is what kills you. I walk through the black Indiana night, under a ceiling of stars, and think about the phrase, elegance and euphoria, and how it describes exactly what I feel with Violet. For once, I don't want to be anyone but Theodore Finch, the boy she sees. He understands what it is to be elegant and euphoric, and 100 different people, most of them flawed and stupid, part asshole, part screw-up, part freak, a boy who wants to be easy for the folks around him so that he doesn't worry them, and, most of all, easy for himself. A boy who belongs. Here, in the world. Here, in his own skin. He is exactly who I want to be, and what I want my epitaph to say. The boy Violet Markey loves. Finch. Day 30, and I am awake. In gym, Charlie Donahue and I stand on the baseball field, way beyond third base. We've discovered this is the best place to be if you want to have a conversation. Without even looking, he catches a ball that comes zinging our way and flings it back to home. Every athletic coach at Bartlett High has been trying to recruit him since he first walked through the school doors, but he refuses to be a black stereotype. His extracurriculars are chess, yearbook, and euchre club, because, as he says, these are things that will make him stand out on college applications. Right now, he crosses his arms and frowns at me. Is it true you almost drowned, Romer? Something like that. Always finish what you start, man. I thought it was a good idea not to get myself incarcerated before I have a chance to get laid again. Getting arrested might actually increase your odds of getting laid. Not the kind of odds I'm looking for. So what's up with you anyway? Look at you. I wish I could take the credit, but let's face it, the gym uniform is universally flattering. Cheeky wanker. He calls me this even though I'm no longer British. Goodbye, Fiona. Goodbye, Flat. Goodbye, Abbey Road. I mean, you've been Dirtbag Finch for a while now. Before that, you were Badass Finch for a couple weeks. You're slipping. Maybe I like Dirtbag Finch. I adjust the knit cap, and it suddenly hits me. Which Finch does Violet like? The thought burns a little, and I can feel my mind latch onto it. Which Finch does she like? What if it's only a version of the real Finch? Charlie offers me a cigarette, and I shake my head. What's going on with you? Is she your girlfriend? Violet? Did you hit that yet, or what? My friend, you are a total and complete pig. And I'm just having a good time. Obviously not too good a time. Romer comes up to bat, which means we have to pay attention, because not only is he the school's star baseball player, second only to Ryan Cross, he likes to aim right at us. If it wouldn't get him in trouble, he'd probably come over here now and smash my head in with the bat for nearly drowning him. Sure enough, the ball comes flying at us, and, cigarette between his teeth, Charlie steps backward once, twice, once more, as if he's not in any hurry, as if he knows he's got this. He holds out his glove, and the ball falls right into it. Romer yells about 1,500 expletives as Charlie sends it flying right back. I nod over at Mr. Cappell, our teacher, who also happens to be the baseball coach. You do know that every time you do that, you make him die just a little. Cappy or Romer? Both. He flashes me a rare grin. I do. In the locker room, Romer corners me. Charlie is gone. Cappell is in his office. The guys who haven't left yet fade away into the background like they're trying to go invisible. Romer leans in so close, I can smell the eggs he had for breakfast. You're dead, freak. Much as I would love to kick the shit out of Gabe Romero, I'm not going to. One, because he's not worth getting into trouble for, and, two, because I remember the look on Violet's face at the river when she told me to let him go. So I count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I will hold it in. I won't punch him in the face. I will be good. And then he slammed